Let's welcome everybody to the show. We do indeed welcome you. We took a couple weeks off. Can't remember now. I think we met before Thanksgiving and then took a couple weeks off.
We had a problem. We were off a couple of weeks because of Gary.
True. And then, of course, Gary's passing on November 9th, which are still knocked for a loop on that. But of course, compared to his family, very difficult times indeed. Let's start out with our prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Larry?
Joe?
What comes after that?
That is King, the power and glory forever and ever. Amen.
Amen.
Oh, all okay. All right.
So tonight we're going to talk about delegation of authority. It's an important topic, and we're going to start with Sean. So Sean, go ahead and launch the rockets.
Well, good evening to everybody across the United States, and I'm glad to have you here tonight. What we want to discuss tonight is the authority of the Internal Revenue Service. I've been asked many, many times over the last many, many decades, where does the IRS find their authority to do what they do? And generally, very basically, it works like this. Congress, the legislative branch of our government, enacts a statute that says, here's what we're going to do in order to enforce and collect the Internal Revenue Code laws. And from that statute, because Congress is a really busy body, they can't take care of every little detail that needs to be attended to when they make these statutes. So generally what they do, Congress does, is they say, when the statute itself is not self-explanatory, they say, when required by regulation, the Secretary of the Treasury, now remember I'm just talking about tax law right now, the Secretary of Treasury shall have, and then they go off to tell the Secretary of Treasury that in order to carry out this statute, you must enact a regulation consistent with the statute. That's where the basics of the authority, the beginning, the origin of the authority of the Secretary of Treasury down to the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service, down to the lower level agents begins. It begins at the congressional level when a statute is enacted. There are several kinds of regulations, but for purposes of taxation, I'm just going to speak about a couple. Joe, I sent you a document, I believe, that discusses regulations, types of regulations.
And, yeah, it's up on the screen.
Okay. And one of the tax code sections that has been enacted in Congress is 26 U.S. Code 7805, entitled Rules and Regulations, and it explains, except where such authority is expressly given to this title to any person other than an officer or employee of the Treasury Department, the Secretary shall prescribe all needful rules and regulations for the enforcement of this title. In other words, what Congress is saying is, we made a law, we've got no clue how we're going to carry it out, but we're going to let the Secretary of State write regulations to carry out what we intended to accomplish by our legislation. There's a couple of types of regulations. In fact, there's several, but there's only three that pertain very directly to the Internal Revenue Service. One of them is legislative regulations. And basically what a legislative regulation is when it comes to the Internal Revenue Service is explained as this. The Internal Revenue Code authorizes the IRS to provide operational rules for specific IRS provisions. In other words, the Secretary has to go to a statute that was enacted by Congress. Generally, legislative regulations carry the same weight of authority as the law itself. The regulation typically refers to statutory authority. So when you have a legislative regulation enacted by the Secretary of Statutes of Treasury to carry out the statute, he says, pursuant to this statute Congress has passed, here's how we're going to implement the statute. And it has the same weight as the law Congress passed. That's pretty important. The next one that's very important too is the interpretive regulations. This is when the IRS goes on and looks at a statute and says, you know what, here's what we think. We think this is what Congress means by what they want to achieve, and this is how we're going to interpret the statute. And it has to be a reasonable interpretation, not the only interpretation, but something that the courts will decide is reasonable interpretation of the statute, and will enact a regulation, and we're pretty much going to be governed by it. We're going to hold the public to it also. There's a problem here, and Congress has been trying to fix it for many years, called Chevron deference. Chevron deference is based upon a case that the United States Supreme Court decided back in 1984. And it was Chevron USA Incorporated versus Natural Resources Defense Council. The site is 467 U.S. 387. And basically what that case said is that when the secretary or some other person that has been delegated authority makes a regulation that reasonably describes the interpretation of the statute, the Supreme Court's going to give this interpretation much deference. In other words, unless you can show us basically, and I've read a lot of case, lower court cases about this, unless you can show us that the commissioner or the secretary of treasury's interpretation of the statute is absolutely crazy or irrelevant to the statute, we're going to adopt it, even if there's something more reasonable. Doesn't matter if it's more reasonable. All that matters is that if the administrator's interpretation of the statute is reasonable. This is basically how our regulations and statutes have given authority to the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Treasury, excuse me, who then gives it to the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service, who the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service then delegates this authority to lower level agents, as Larry is going to explain to you shortly. There's a document I sent off to you, Joe, if you could bring it up, the titled the Department of Treasury Internal Revenue Service, January 24th, 1996, where someone questioned, you know, just exactly what kind of regulations the IRS can enact and what kind of an impact it has on the people. And it pretty much mirrors what I've explained to you. And this is what Cheryl Kordick, at that time chief assistant section in the IRS, said. She says regulations are authorized by the Internal Revenue Code section 7805, which is correct. And they constitute the primary source of guidance on the Treasury's position regarding the interpretation of the code. So this is where they get the authority, again, from Congress. She goes on to say in the next paragraph, legislative regulations are those for which the service is specifically authorized by the code to prescribe the operating rules. In other words, the statute says, when prescribed by regulation, in other words, the statute says a regulation has to be enacted to carry out this statute. And unless it exceeds the scope of the statute, in other words, if the regulation says we're going to require more than the law requires, the regulation is going to fail. So if it stays within the ambit of the statute, the regulation will be honored by the court. And then there's the interpretive regulations. And as they go on to say in the third paragraph, the interpretive regulations do not have the force and effect of law. However, the courts give them substantial weight. There we go back to the Chevron doctrine. If the United States Supreme Court or a district court or court of appeals says, you know what, that's an interpretation I don't know that I would agree with, but it sounds reasonable, we're not going to disturb it. Even though there might be four or five other interpretations that are reasonable, since this is one that's been adopted, this is the one we're going to keep. By the way, as I said previously, Congress is trying to change the Chevron deference doctrine. I think it's a bad doctrine. That's my personal opinion. And then procedural regulations are regulations that just tell the IRS how they should go about doing things. Let me give you an example. If the IRS says, in order to cash a treasury check for the Department of Treasury the agent will take a trip down to the United States Commerce Bank, and he'll go by 3rd Street and 4th Avenue to get there. Well, that's telling him how he should do it, but it's not a requirement. He can go by some other street. In other words, the regulation, this procedural regulation, is not an end to accomplishing what needs to take place. It's just a suggestion as to how it should take place. Now, that's how the regs work, from my understanding of it, very simple understanding of it right now. But then the question becomes, how does the delegation of authority that comes from the statute, that goes to a regulation, that actually empowers the Secretary of the Treasury to say, you know what, I'm kind of busy too. I'm like the congressman, I'm kind of busy. I don't have the time to do all this. So how does he go about delegating his authority to enact all of these rules and regulations to apply the income tax laws? If you go to 26 U.S.C. section 7701 under definitions, you're going to find the definition of Secretary of the Treasury and Secretary. And here's how they define it. They say the term Secretary of the Treasury means the Secretary of Treasury personally and shall not include any delegate of his. Then it goes on to explain that when the term secretary is simply used, it means the secretary or his delegate. And this is one of the statutes inside the Internal Revenue Code, which allows the Secretary of the Treasury to delegate his authority down the chain to the IRS commissioner, which allows him to delegate his authority down the chain to lesser agents of the IRS, which Larry is going to explain, you're going to find very interesting. So Larry.
Well, you want me to start?
You bet.
Okay. Hey, Joe, since I woke up with a cold this morning and I have been blowing my nose all day, I think I will keep my camera off so people don't have to look at me as I blow my nose periodically. But let's get it, you know, earlier this evening, Sean is the one that brought this idea of let's get into this particular topic. Well, to me, you know, people that are interested in the tax issue, but don't devote a whole lot of time to it. You know, they depend upon people like us to kind of discuss these matters. And this matter that Sean has suggested as a topic of tonight's discussion is one of those topics that, you know, to understand it, you know, you have to really dig into it. But it is also something that can be explained so that people can understand the whole issue. And I'm going to explain this issue of, you know, delegated authority and how it developed. You know, there's a whole history behind all this. And it relates to, you know, getting back into the time that our country was founded, you know, back in the 1790s. You know, what was it like back then? And then just take it over time, you know, this country has grown. You know, I think that there was a little over 3 million people back in the 1790s. That was the population of the United States at that time. By the time you get up to the Civil War, there might have been, you know, 60 or 70 million people in this country. By the time you get into 1900, there might be about 100 million people in this country. And today we've got, you know, 330 million people. We've had a tremendous growth. But also over the same period of time, we've gone to, you know, back in the 1790s, newspapers were just big sheets, you know, one piece of paper printed off on a very rudimentary printing press. And, you know, we didn't have the means of communication that we have now back then. It was very, very rudimentary. You wrote letters, you depended upon the postal service. You know, we didn't have phones, we didn't have the internet. It was a very different time when print media was entirely different and certainly wasn't any electronic forms of communications. So you have to take that into consideration, you know, when you're looking at, you know, how did all of this really get developed? Now, having laid that foundation, let's kind of get into a little bit of the, you know, how the government has grown, how the agencies have been created and grown, and how, you know, the agencies have been given authority to do certain things. Now, Joe, I don't think we need to get into this issue of, I want to end with the necessity for delegated authority, but can you pull up the other one, 28 USC 7802. Did you have that? Or I had one that had all of the sections in the 7800s. You know, it's kind of a table of contents. You're on one of those.
Well,
I sent you a link to it.
Yeah, you probably did it to me again where you sent it like at 1 minute till, because there were two links in an email.
Those are the links to my page, but then later on when I was talking to Sean, you know, I sent you just a link, and it's a you know, if you can check your email.
Yeah, let me.
You know, but kind of pull that up. But let's get back to the very beginning, you know, and when our government in 1791, 1792 is just beginning to operate, you know, you can go back into old treasury documents to see how much money was raised for the operation of the federal government. And back in those days, the entire receipts, 3 million people in this country produced around between $2 and $3 million in revenue for the federal government. And that was the amount that was used to pay for the operation of the federal government. By the time you get up into the War of 1812, you know, I think the receipts of Uncle Sam was something like $12 to $13 million. Isn't that phenomenal that the federal government was able to operate with that kind of receipts back in those days? By the time you get up into the Civil War era, you know, expenditures greatly exceeded receipts. But, you know, the Civil War was being conducted on, you know, expenditures of several hundred million per year. You know, I think 300 million, 400 million, 500 million in the way of expenditures during one of the years during the Civil War. That was a whole lot of money. So from those humble beginnings, you know, where are we today? You know, today, you know, I can remember years ago when I was thinking, you know, $1 billion is a lot of money. No, $1 billion is not a whole lot at all. Now we're talking about trillions. And so there's been this huge growth in, you know, the operation and size of the federal government. And there's been a huge growth in the number of people in this country. So things, and over that period of time when we've gone from newspapers being on a big sheet of paper, you know, just one big sheet of paper running off of a printing press, to, you know, now we no longer have very many newspapers, but, you know, newspapers were a whole lot different from the way they were back in the 1790s. Well, there's been a big change over the same period of time in the way the federal government was set up to operate and how that was accomplished, delegating the authority to various agencies. But let's start off by 1791. You know, the only major, you had the courts and you had the Treasury Department, and of course you had Congress. And those were the big departments of government. Of course you had a minuscule army at that point in time. But you know, that's basically the size of the federal government. Or in reference to delegating authority, you know, Congress would come along and enact these laws. You know, say that there are some piracies and felonies of the high seas crimes that Congress enacts. You know, they would do things like give jurisdiction of those crimes to the courts. But then, you know, the laws that related to the creation of the courts also directed the authority of the judges. You know, Congress could come along and pass a law. Oh, the judges can do this and the judges can do that. Well, you know, as the government grew, you know, the plethora of agencies began to grow. You know, the original agency for all the other agencies was the Treasury Department. Out of the Treasury Department, virtually everything else kind of grows. You know, the regulation of commerce started off and really as a way to, you know, to deal with taxation. But then, you know, when Congress comes along and passes these laws for the regulation of commerce, they would delegate that authority to the Treasury Department because the Treasury Department is already doing that. But over time, as the activities of that in that field began to grow, they'd create another agency. Well, what Congress has done over the years is they will come along with a law, and we're going to get into the taxing laws here in a minute, but they'll come along with a law. And a lot of times they come along after there's more activity in the field that that law applies to, they'll create an agency to, you know, administer that law. And when they create that agency to administer that law, they'll usually come along and by statute appoint somebody in a particular department to administer that law. Now, let's get around to the Treasury Department. You know, when this country was created, you know, the excises, duties, and imposts were the primary source of revenue for the federal government. That was the taxes at the border. Well, you know, the Congress would come along and create these ports of entry and require, you know, commerce to flow through those ports of entry. And certain taxes would be imposed upon those imported goods. And of course, they had to create, you know, customs bureaus inside the Department of Treasury. They would do all these things. So Congress would, you know, when they would come along and impose a tax, you know, the same law's got to deal with the administration of that tax. And so they would say the head of the Customs Department would, you know, have authority to do thus and such. And that's the way it was all the way through the time of the Civil War. It was very, very rudimentary. Congress would pass a law. There'd be an agency in existence. There'd be a public official in existence. And then they would just come along with a law. Then that law would say, oh, you know, this law shall be administered and enforced by this public official. Well, the same thing has happened with the tax laws. You know, from the very beginning, the Secretary of the Treasury has been the guy that's had the authority to administer and enforce the various tax laws of the United States. And of course, he's had various bureaus and departments below him. You know, like starting off at the beginning of this country, you know, the customs was real important, the revenue cutter and things like that. You know, the Secretary of the Treasury would have to get a customs director, and the customs director would hire the people that would work at the ports of entry. And then you'd have to train these people over what was taxed and what wasn't taxed. So, you know, that's the way it was all the way until the time of the Civil War. With the time of the Civil War, when war broke out, you know, there was a great need for more expenditures. There was also a great need for more revenue. And that's when Congress came along and, you know, came out with the first income tax that the federal government imposed. It was back, there was one in 1861. And it was revised in 1862. And, you know, when all of this happened, you know, Congress came along and, you know, now they got a lot more expenditures and they're needing to raise a lot more revenue. And so the activities of the Treasury Department greatly increased. So at the Civil War era, you had a transition. You know, basically the revenues of the federal government was derived primarily from these external taxes, you know, collected at the border. And now they got this internal tax. And, you know, we're not going to get into the income tax, you know, how it operated, you know, but what definitely happened is that was to become a source of revenue for the federal government. People had to be hired to administer that law. And of course, this was a new law that, you know, came along and, you know, there wasn't any experience in this area. You know, this is a brand new field. You know, the origins of regulations goes back to really that period of time. You know, regulations started off originally, you know, like back during the Civil War, you have this internal tax being imposed for the first time. You have more people employed by the federal government that were involved in the administration of that tax. And so there had to be a way of communicating between the national office and the field. And so the beginning days of regulations were these directives that came out of Washington, D.C., the, you know, Treasury Department up there, giving directions to, you know, customs people and, you know, internal revenue agents and stuff like that. You know, they're whole books. You can go back and you can find some stuff on the internet even today. You can see the beginning, you know, works. You know, if you went into a law library, and this is what I did when I was in law school, you know, I would see these, and I'm looking at some of them. I've got these old versions of you know, the old treasury regulations. I'm looking at them up there on the, in my, you know, bookcase here in my office. You know, there were books, and you can go into the law libraries and see these books, and you can see, like, in the span of 20 and 30 years, those books dealing with one particular topic go from something that's thin, maybe, you know, for 1 year, it might be one quarter of an inch thick, to within 15 years, you know, you got a book that's an inch and a half or maybe 2 inches thick. You know, that's the way things grew. And the way they, way it grew is because there was more bigger, there was a greater need for greater sums of money. Congress was imposing taxes on a larger number of things. It was employing a lot more people. And so there had to be a lot more communications between the national office and the field. And that was done by printing these directions to people out in the field. Those are the beginning days of regulations. That's the way regulations started off. So by the time you get up into the 1870s and 1880s, you know, you got Department of the Interior, you got the Department of Commerce, you got the Treasury Department. You know, those are some big agencies. They're doing a lot of things. And so the agencies of necessity find that, you know, the national office has got to communicate with those in the field, and they're doing it by, you know, no longer we progress from, you know, newspapers being printed by your Benjamin Franklins on a big sheet of paper. You know, now we have, you know, in 1865, 1866, 1867, you know, you've got the real beginnings of real newspapers. And so there was even a newspaper for the Treasury Department that came out once a week. And, you know, the people that were interested in getting this, finding about what is internally going on in the Treasury Department, if they, you know, I could see if you were somebody that was in the import business, you would subscribe to this newspaper, Internal Revenue Bulletin. And, you know, you would read what the instructions were being given from the national office to the field. And you can see why there was a real need, you know, when you have taxes on, let's say, imported cotton dresses having a content of 50% of cotton or more. You know, whoa, there's got to be some way for the people in the field, you know, for everything, as they're going through these goods that are sitting there on the dock coming in, and all they want to do is collect the tax on it. And the taxes, you know, if they got all these wild taxes out there, there's got to be some way to make this process of collecting the taxes efficient. So, you know, while Congress would be coming along and saying, you know, there's a tax of 50 cents per dress, you know, if the dress is 50% of cotton or more, you know, there's got to be a way so that the guy at the customs office will know without having to conduct a test. And so what the Treasury Department would say is, well, you know, the Jacques Cousteau dress company in Paris, France, you know, its dresses that are being imported right now only have, you know, 40% cotton. So there's no tax on it. But the dresses coming from this dress manufacturer in London, oh, they have, you know, 60% cotton. So you collect the taxes from these dresses. So that's, you know, it was very practical, you know, this means of communication, written communication from the national office to in the field. That then becomes a foundation for rules and regulations. By the time you get up into the 1890s, you know, it's so well established that there is this literature coming from the national office of these federal agencies that, you know, now that, you know, there's a name attached to those, that printed material. Oh, gee, hey, I've got a call coming in. I'm going to turn off that's my wife.